Preston and Steve Fun Size Podcast.
We have a guest who we are delighted to speak to this morning, and he and his band have done amazing things throughout the year, especially been such a massive impression on one Mr. Nick McElwain right here in our very own studio. But he also does amazing work outside of music, and that's one of the things we're going to talk to him about. Please welcome from the band Pearl Jam, Mr. Jeff Ament to the program. Hey, Jeff, how you doing, man?
It's going pretty good. It's still a little early in the West Coast, but
I got it. Hey, thank you so much for getting up early. Listen, I want to get this out of the way because I want to hear it straight from the horse's mouth. Ament, 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 what do you prefer?
It's Ament.
Ament, okay.
Which I think there's been some confusion over the years. I think my name has been pronounced many different ways from the stage, and I think that's been a confusion.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. It's like Carmine Appice, you know, the drummer. The people can't get his name right for whatever reason.
Appice, right.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, listen, Jeff, we had a conversation a week or two ago. I had found an article that was talking about skateboarding, and I just brought it up as kind of a quick, hey, you know, take a listen to this. And it turned out to a lengthy conversation with people calling in. And the gist of it was that there was a guy that was recommending that people in their, you know, middle age range, you know, 40s and 50s and so on, to combat things like depression and loneliness, try skateboarding. We got so many phone calls from people who were almost choked up in telling us what this activity means to them. And does that come to any surprise to you?
No, it doesn't. I think I've been asking myself for the last 20 years, like, why am I still doing this? Because I'm approaching 60. But there is a joy and a focus and a freedom that you feel when you're on your skateboard, and it's a little bit dangerous, so that adds a little something to it too. But and there's a camaraderie of the people that I've met, like, all over the world that do it. It feels like it's kind of a small group. And a lot of the people my age that still skateboard grew up with punk rock and kind of all the things that sort of got me out of where I am at this point in my life. And so there's a lot to talk about. You know, you talk to somebody from the Netherlands, you know, who's 50 something skateboarding, and he was listening to the same music that I was listening to in Big Sandy, Montana, which is kind of a cool thing.
Well, so. Yeah. Everything you're mentioning was echoed, as Preston said, by the callers who were revealing some had gone through some issues, you know, recently or whatever, got back to it. There was one guy who picked it up. He was in his 50s, never skateboarded before.
Wow.
But loved it. And I think there is that. For some, it's nostalgia. For others, and a lot of people mentioned the joy of kind of gliding, of moving along that way, of that that sense of freedom. Whatever it was and whatever it continues to be, it speaks to people. Obviously, what you do, you're very much involved in making the skateboard parks accessible to kids. Because honestly, as you hear this and see this, that foundation with these older gentlemen was and women was set, you know, many years ago, and here you have a whole bunch of new people who are embracing it. So when did this become a mission statement for you to get out there and to make this a more accessible thing for kids?
Well, it started probably 25 years ago with the skate park in Seattle, and as time has gone on, it's just sort of built and built and built, and it's been real natural. It hasn't, you know, there really wasn't a point until maybe 3 or 4 years ago where I was like, okay, like let's have some goals and let's start talking to some people and let's get some more things done. Let's get more people involved. Let's try to raise some money, different things. And I think, you know, it's like anything that you get involved with, like the more you get involved with it, the more people that you meet, the more excited you get about it. And it just sort of, it's just sort of built into this really cool, collective, in my home state. And it's put me back in touch with people that I grew up with. And it's, connected me with all these small towns in a very large state. And it's gotten me just sort of around the state a little bit more. And and my wife and I don't have kids, so it's been a really great way to be connected to young people and find out what what's going on, you know, what's TikTok and all that. You know,
right. Well, for those who may not be familiar with what you've done, Jeff has created and paid for 27 high-end skate parks. And the number may be different than that, but that's the latest that I've seen in Montana and some in South Dakota and so on through a foundation that you've set up. And I love the fact that you are putting these – Montana is such a beautiful state. It's gorgeous. It's big sky country, and it's big sky because – there's not a lot of stuff in areas. It's a lot of frontier. And so, therefore, the skate park is like a more of a metropolis type thing. It's what you find in populated areas. They're going to be more common. So you've reached out to these smaller communities and built what might be considered a bit of a luxury item for people. So that's really got to open up the doors for some people. Is that part of what's important about this, getting it out to those further communities?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I grew up in Big Sandy, which is super, super isolated. Like we were, you know, 35 miles from a town of 10,000 and we were 85 miles from a town of 50,000. So we were sort of out in the middle of, and it's beautiful there. There's like the Bear Paw Mountains and the Missouri River where Lewis and Clark hung out. And there's, you know, amazing history in that area. But I think it was, you know, this has been a way to sort of connect these young kids in these isolated areas with, you know, like a world-class skate park. It sort of connects them with the rest of the world. I mean, these kids all have phones and all have access to what's going on in the rest of the world. And I think in some ways that can make you lonelier. You know, I think I felt that way as a kid, and that was from getting, like, you know, a couple of magazines a month. So if you're getting reminded every day on your phone that, you know, Kim Kardashian and, whatever, just like wealth and people that have, you know, everything and are handsome and beautiful. And this is just a way to bring, like, I know all these guys. I know the guys in Grindline and Dreamland, these guys that build these skate parks. And I've been working with Evergreen the last 10 years. And so we're building as good of a skate park as you'd see in New York City. We're building those parks in Montana or in Philadelphia, for that matter.
You know, it's amazing because I remember clearly when, you know, this is, you know, when the skateboarding stuff kicked in again, you know, we were our show was, you know, on an alternative rock station. And it was just the beginning of you know, seeing the signs of it catch on, and then you saw the Jackass folks, and you saw, you know,
Tony Hawk and X Games, all
that started to kick in. And again, it just, I think, as you're saying, Jeff, it immediately resonated with all sorts of people who might, in their own way, feel isolated. And this community kicked up, and it's obviously has stood the test of time. But also, there's so many things when we were talking to the callers who were calling, and they were mentioning about the lessons that it teaches you about it can't get any more obvious that when you fall down you need to get back up, and all of these things help inform a way someone can approach life.
That to me is the biggest lesson. Like, if you have to fall over and over and over and over again to learn a trick, and so it's amazing to watch these kids take a ride. Like, some of these communities, we bring skateboards in, and you see them take their first rides, and you can tell by the kid that falls and laughs and gets back up and goes to the top and does it again. You can tell that that's the kid who in a year or two you're going to come back and he's just going to be tearing the place up.
And that's
been the amazing thing. Like, there's a few parks that, you know, a park we built in Browning on the Blackfeet Reservation 7 years ago. There's a crew of kids there. There's this core crew of kids. There's seven or eight guys, and they are the tightest, coolest crew that I've ever witnessed. It's like, you know, it's how you wished you grew up and you had like these seven guys that had your back, and they talk about heavy stuff, and they're so grown up and so functional as a crew. And I'm just proud of those kids that they sort of found each other through skateboarding and, you know, the lessons they've learned through, you know, falling and getting up and talking to each other and hanging out. So,
Speaking of falling and getting up, and you said you're getting close to 60. You have a European tour with Pearl Jam. Will you taper off your skateboarding a couple of months before that to make sure that no unfortunate accident happens?
You know, the key to all this stuff at this point in my life is that you got to keep doing it, but you just learn to, like, you know, if you're feeling great, you can step it up and skate harder and do a few tricks. And if you're not feeling great, or if you have a tour coming up, then you can just sort of dial it back and cruise. And I wear some pads and helmet and all that, a wrist guard. Right. I mean, I hope we go to Europe. I mean, what the hell's going on with this virus? I mean,
right. Yeah. You don't know what's going to happen between now and then. Speaking of the band, Ed, do any of them, have they skated? Are they, I know that, you know, Ed surfs as part of his life. Anybody else into skating sports?
You know, I think all those guys skated at one time or another. And Mike still skates a little bit because he's got a couple kids that love to skateboard. So I've set him up with a board. They understand it. At this point, like, nobody's gonna tell each other that they can't do something.
right.
Why waste the effort,
Jeff? If communities are interested in getting assistance from you and your foundation, what are the steps they need to take? And you know, because you can only do so much. But what can people do to reach out and maybe try to get something in their community?
We have a website, MontanaPoolService.com. You can reach us through there. And if people are super excited about it, they can donate there too. We actually have the next 2 years kind of wrapped up. We have, I think, 5 or 6 parks happening this year, and then 4 parks penciled in for 23. So it's pretty exciting. You know, it's like I said, it's really just turned into this, you know, I mean, it's like a, you know, like a part-time job for me almost.
Wow, that's cool. How many years has this been active?
It's been really active for about 10 years. When we built a park in Big Sandy, well, we built a park in Missoula about 15 years ago, but when we built a park in my hometown 10 years ago, it started to pick up after that, so.
Cool.
Jeff Preston mentioned the European tour, and it's still kind of weird times. Nobody quite knows how to plan terribly far in advance, but you guys had in 2020 on the slate a North American tour. I was planning on coming to see you in Phoenix, and then that got blew up. So are there plans afoot for possibly a North American tour, especially in a town like, I don't know, Philadelphia for this fall?
Right. We have all sorts of stuff penciled in.
Okay.
I mean, we sort of talk about this stuff every 2 or 3 weeks, and Ed's got a tour. He's going to go out on here in a couple of weeks, so he's going to be the guinea pig for it. he's going to see how it goes, and you know how the testing goes and all that stuff. So we did the 4 shows, you know, this last just a few months ago, and that, I mean, it was so much fun, and it was so great just to be with the guys and the crew and see some fans. And so, you know, I've never been like, I love playing, but I haven't been the guy in the band who's just like wanting to go tour for the whole year. And I can't wait. Like I'm really ready to get out. And I mean, I haven't been to the East Coast in 2 years, which is, you know, I'm jonesing right now.
Come and get it, man. It's here.
Yeah. I'm ready.
Jeff, with your band, with your extensive catalog and the way you guys tour, I mean, sometimes it'll just, you know, be a handful of dates here and there and so on. And Ed, from what I understand, just kind of puts together a playlist and says, you know, kind of here's what I'm feeling. Here's what we're going to play. Are you kind of a plug in and go kind of band? Like, you've worked so long together that really a full on rehearsal isn't even that necessary. You just plug it in. Here we go.
I think we could kind of do that now. Before these 4 shows last fall, we rehearsed for about 10 days, and mostly it was rehearsing the new songs, just because there's a lot of keyboards and background vocals and percussion, just weird, you know, stuff that we kind of haven't had. So, and we hadn't played in, you know, 3-4 years or something like that. So, I think now we could probably, you know, have 2 or 3 rehearsals and kind of get out there and knock it out. And then once we get out there, you just keep digging into the back catalog, and you know, people will bring up song titles, and you work on it in the hotel room, and then you get a backstage, and you get to play it once or twice, and then
Well, that's what I like about that's what I like about your band. You know, and I think Rolling Stone did a cool article on you guys a few years back, just sort of likening you guys and your following to the Grateful Dead, in the sense that, you know, when you do, you know, a show, the general fan there is just as excited to hear the radio hit as they are to hear like a deep track off of an album that, you know, most people don't know, and so your following is really, really dialed into, you know, your entire catalog.
Yeah, that's one of the beautiful things about, you know, still being in the band at this point, 30 years on, is that we do have this crazy back catalog, and it kind of keeps us on our toes. And pretty much anywhere we go, there's signs up for, you know, just really, really deep cuts. Like, you know, the cuts that we've played, like, three times or whatever. And so, I love that part of it. I don't think I could be in a band at this point where you're just playing the 20 hits every night over and over and over again.
But with that rabid fan base about the brand new stuff, do you still have, you know, bathroom song, you know?
right. Yeah,
I mean, I'm curious too, because it seems like sometimes bands will play a brand new song and then you'll see a quarter of the audience leave because they're not interested in the brand new stuff. But it seems like your group, well, they just don't go to the bathroom; they just stand there and soil themselves.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably some people that, you know, I think sometimes the new songs take a few years, you know, like to sort of rise to the top. You know, we don't even know at this point like what songs off the last record, you know, will be ones that we play, you know, more often than not. So,
yeah, I know you guys were excited to play stuff off of Gigaton on the last tour, and then that had to get shelved. But I also wanted to ask you, while we have you on the phone, and I wanted to pass on greetings from your buddy Matt Cord, your thoughts on the Sixers, and in particular the Ben Simmons situation.
Man, like they just got a deal with Ben Simmons. Like, what's Daryl doing? Like, you know,
nobody wants him. Like, or not for the. It's just a, you know,
CJ McCollum.
What's that?
I said CJ McCollum would be a great fit. I've heard a bunch of names like that seem like it'd be good trades. And they're doing pretty well without him. So that part of it's they got to be excited about that. I mean.
Well, yeah,
he is a beast,
and he's had just an amazing run of the last like 8, 9, 10 games or whatever. But it's frustrating because, you know, as a fan, as an outsider sort of looking in, you're like, well, this is what the guy's worth, right? And then the other owners and GMs are going, no, he's not. You know, he's not where, you know. And so it's just this back and forth. You know, as an outsider, it's like this is an easy deal, is it not? I mean, look at it. This is a, you know, 6'10", 6'11" guy who can handle the ball like a point guard and, you know, dishes it out. But it's, you know, I guess there's a lot more to it than what, you know, I'm privy to.
Is there something to be said for having a player on your team who can actually sign autographs during the game?
Well, he's a he's clearly a fragile dude. So
yeah.
I think that's the part that people are probably a little leery about, but.
Yeah, and you know what? Listen, there's that aspect of it that we just don't understand as, you know, as everyday people. You don't, and we had Chris Long on our show a couple of days ago, and, you know, he played in the NFL for a number of years, and he just talked about the immense pressure that these athletes feel, and we'll never understand that, right? We don't play in front of, you know, and let me ask you about that. As a musician, you know, and you've been doing this for a long, long time, do you still get butterflies when you walk onto the stage in front of, whether it be, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 people?
Sure. I mean, you know, especially when you're playing stuff for the first time, and, you know, if you have a featured part, or if you're, you know, if you're the glue of the song and your performance, like, you know, the success of the performance hinges on what you're doing. Like, that's for sure. And I always say, like, yeah, it doesn't seem like much with bass, but when you miss a note playing bass, the whole crowd knows it. guitars can get up there and sort of scratch around and miss some notes and nobody notices, but it's like, you really can't, like, if you're the singer and if you're playing bass, and if you're the drummer, like, if you're just hacking up there, like, Yeah, I think it's different in the pro sports because those guys are like 20 years old,
young.
Yeah, super young.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. Listen, I'm coaching. I coach basketball. I coach my son's team, a bunch of 14-year-old kids. They're not playing in front of 20,000 people, but you'll see them pass on an open shot because. And I tell them, like, dude, just take the shot. Take the shot. You know, right. Michael Jordan said it himself, you miss 100% of the shots that you don't take, right? So, like, just take it, right. and let's not worry about whether it goes in or not. Just take an open shot, and I don't ever want to see you guys pass an open shot again. But, so. That's a 14-year-old kid, Ben Simmons and all these guys. They're
6 years old.
They're 6 year old, but they're still, it's a fragile mind.
Yeah.
I think it's just reminding yourself, too, that you're playing. You know, they call it playing music. They call it playing sports. Like, yeah. You have to play.
Yeah.
I think, and don't put, it's like, you're not performing heart surgery here. Hopefully nobody's going
to
die.
Yeah, they never say, do you want to play heart surgery?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's supposed to be fun,
Right.
It's supposed to be fun for you guys. It's supposed to be fun for the audience. I didn't get to see any of the four shows last year, Jeff, the festival shows. And so I didn't get a chance to see you guys play with Josh yet, Josh Klinghoffer. What has that been like? And he's a new member of the band, but he's played with Ed in the past. So what was it like for you having essentially a new member of Pearl Jam?
Yeah, I've loved Josh forever. Like, the handful of times that I've seen him with Chili Peppers over the years, like, we would have these, I think we sort of enjoy the same kind of weird, eclectic music. Like, he's way into, like, the no wave scene in New York and a lot of weird jazz and ambient music. And so we have these great conversations about that stuff. I just love him. He sort of brought a super cool energy to what we're doing, and we really love his Plural One Records. That we, initially we were just excited to have him out playing with us. And then when we started hanging out, he was like, "Hey, I could sing that part, or I could do this." And he's a crazy good musician, can play keyboards, drums, whatever. So it's just been fun to have a new infusion of energy into the band, and he's easy, easy to get along with. So
he's going to be with Ed when he does his solo shows coming up. Yeah. Chad Smith on that tour as well. We just played the new track "Brother of the Cloud" 45 minutes ago or so. Have you spent any time with Ed's new album?
I just got the whole record yesterday, so okay. I just heard "Brother of the Cloud." I heard it once yesterday, which is kind of a heavy number from what I could gather. I didn't look at the lyrics, but I mean, Ed will whenever I hear first lyrics from Ed, it's all that. A lot of times, there's always a couple lines that hit me pretty deep, and that was definitely one of them. So
they send you the record?
I can't wait to see his band.
Did they send you the record, or did you have to go out to buy it?
I got a disc. I got a 10% off.
Oh, you're in the band. You get 10% off.
That pays to know people like
that. I love that you dove right into lyrically what was being said, because I can listen to a song for years and not tell you what the song is about. Is that because, Ed is the wordsmith and you'll gravitate towards that because it's mainly him that you're paying attention to? Or is that the way you are with music when you'll take it in usually the first time? You'll pay attention to the whole thing musically, lyrically, the whole message.
Well, I think as a kid, when I bought records, and it was one of those things where you bought a record once a month, but it was like you open the package up and the first time that you listen to it, you read along the lyrics. And I think to this day, that's sort of how I prefer to listen to music for the first time. If I can actually just like put my headphones on and just sort of read the lyrics as the song's going by. I'm in a band with like one of the great, singers, lyricists, of our time. So racist. I'm always curious, like where, cause he's always kind of shifting, he's shifting his style and I'm always curious on where he's headed. So, I don't have the lyrics for. I need to get the lyrics to the new record.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. Let me ask you, as a musician, what are, and by the way, I love the Cameron Crowe documentary, 25. It was just awesome, and I don't, you know what your thoughts are on that. But what are your thoughts and feelings on musical documentaries in general? And is there anyone that sticks out to you?
I love all that stuff. I read all the every rock biography, autobiography. I read all that stuff. I just read the Nico, who's in Velvet Underground. I just read that biography, which is a fascinating book about, you know, mostly about the New York scene, but her background was like crazy too. But the Velvet Underground documentary was amazing. Like so much stuff. I mean, I thought I knew a lot about the Velvet Underground, but that was a
band that I wasn't necessarily familiar with until Fish covered it. They covered it on Halloween a few years back, so I listened to Fish's version first, and then I was like, "All right, well, let me go back and see what this is all about." And they're definitely a darling of
critics.
Of critics and bands right. of other yeah. bands and yeah. other musicians. So, what is it about Velvet Underground that does it for you?
I just think their approach to music was probably less of a musician's angle on music, and it was an artist. It was like sort of painting outside the lines and no rules. And I think they, you know, in the process, they sort of created their own sound and influenced a ton of bands, you know.
Do you guys ever cover Velvet Underground?
We did when we were friendly with Lou Reed, and when he passed, we did Waiting for the Man a couple times. Yeah.
Jeff, I was curious if you saw the Beatles, the Let It Be, Peter Jackson.
Oh my gosh! Yeah,
yeah, right.
I want to watch it again. That Let It Be was the first album I ever bought, and
wow.
And my uncle growing up was a huge Beatles head, and he would let me borrow his singles, and so I've always been pretty obsessed with that record. And so to go that deep and to see their process and to see. Basically, Paul McCartney's eyes roll back in his head and just like just create these songs out of the ether.
Yeah.
Like, the other guys are on the other side of the room working on a tune and he's there like strumming around working on Let It Be. And it turns out to be Let It Be, you know?
Yeah. And then there's a scene where he's just kind of scatting along and very slowly it becomes Get Back. And it's like the birth. I saw it happen. And, you know, and I was curious about because everybody's got their own style and maybe they got to a point of leisure by the time they got to Let It Be because they were the Beatles and they could do what they wanted to. But that whole super loose, just kind of farting around in the studio and just playing and not really having a direction seemed kind of weird to me. Now, I know that earlier on in their career, you know, they only had X amount of hours in the studio. We got to get in. We got to knock this out. We got to do this now. But they just kind of played, and by that I mean like children playing with toys, and I found that kind of surprising.
Yeah. And I think I sort of relate to that part a little bit because in particular early on that was kind of how Pearl Jam wrote songs. You know, somebody might come in with a riff or something, but we sort of made stuff out of nothing, and so to watch the Beatles do that and in particular Paul, like you could tell George and John worked on stuff at home and they would bring it in and have it kind of semi worked out. But Paul was just like, and I've read some stuff since I watched it. I bought the lyrics book or whatever. Actually, my wife got it for me for Christmas. And that's his deal, man. He doesn't want to prepare. He wants to feel that, you know, that energy coursing through his body when he's creating. He wants to create stuff out of nothing. And to me, it's like witnessing like a miracle or something.
Yeah,
like it's always been sort of my religion and my God and whatever. And so to see it on film, to see those songs kind of coming out of nothing was just so magical. So, I was like standing up going like, oh my God, like,
yeah.
He's writing Let It Be over there. All things must pass with George over here, but he's so cool.
Yeah. And so, I know that you guys just released an album like a year ago, but when you watch something like that, do you go, I think I want to get back in the studio with these guys. Like, do you feel any sort of inspiration?
For sure.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's nothing better for me than being in the studio with the guys when everybody's like all in on it. You know, like if everybody's like focused on being there and making music, it's sort of the best thing in life. So, I just sit around the phone all day.
Talking to us.
Well, listen, man, there's a lot of things to be excited about. There's great work you're doing with the skate parks. We're excited about the potential for the band getting on the road, maybe swinging by the East Coast, stopping in Philly and all that. Of course, Ed's got shows coming up. They're close to here, but not right in our backyard. But nonetheless, fans of both he and Pearl Jam can go check him out. So, you know, we're just working on the world getting back to the way it should be. And hopefully you guys will, you and your band will be a big part of coming through Philly and giving us something to be excited about. So, but we just appreciate your time and checking in with us, Jeff.
Well, thanks, you guys. You know, we look forward to being in Philly again. Hopefully it happens here in 22. We're ready. So
excellent.
Miss you.
All right, man.
Yes.
Take care. Thanks for getting up early, dude. Right, we appreciate it. Not easy for a rock star. All right. He said go Sixers. Thank you, Jeff Ament, guys. Wow. Very cool. Very, very, very cool. Super nice guy. And yeah, he's like a huge Sixers fan, man. I forgot about that.
It's so wild.
Yeah. And, you know, every time he comes through town, if they're playing, he'll go and watch a game. And yeah, he's just a big NBA fan in general. But, it was neat. What a great conversation. We chatted with him for a half an hour, you know?
I played in a little shoot-around with him one time. Dude, I don't know how to play basketball. Yeah. I mean, I know how to shoot the ball. I know how to dribble the ball.
You pulled out a handgun.
Oh, my God. But, he was just a dude.
He's
a
really
dude.
Yeah, he plays, like, in a men's league. I got to go with Matt Cord and Kyle Korver and Pierre, and we played at Villanova one time. And Jeff is he's a baller, man. He knows how to, you know, he knows how to hoop.
Nice.
More podcasts from Preston and Steve available at PrestonandSteve.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.